This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's an important collaboration that has just gotten started from Northwest Indiana. The Lake Area United Way is collaborating with Methodist Hospitals and with the help, some financial help from the organization, which is called Early Learning Indiana, is going to be able to create a collaboration which should address problems with health care here in the region, in particular in the city of Gary. With us to talk more about this collaboration and how it's getting started and what's going to happen eventually, we have the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way with us, Lisa Daugherty. Lisa, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the overall transition that the Lake Area United Way has been making in the recent years to try to help Northwest and Indiana, in particular Lake County's low-income families, and in turn how this new collaboration, a very important one, is going to fit in with it.
Chris, in a nutshell, we had announced 5 years ago that we were going to transition to a new model. We went out into the community and we identified a population called ALICE, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. These are folks who are working, but they're not earning enough to afford basic necessities. And in Lake County, we've got about 1 in 4 of our families that fall into that situation. You know, what's challenging for folks in that population is that because they're working, they're not eligible for public assistance. So in a lot of ways, they're more vulnerable than our folks in poverty. So, you know, when we identified ALICE, we again went back out into the community, talked to ALICE families, and we heard a few, you know, different themes, barriers that were extremely challenging for them. You know, the fact that they didn't have a safety net. You know, there's not enough housing stock that is affordable. You know, we all know that healthcare is an issue. You know, one area, healthy food is another. And then the two areas where we landed were on helping ALICE families access livable wage jobs and quality child care. Mm-hmm. And so this collaboration with Methodist is a perfect example of the types of new initiatives that we'll be working on, because we sought funding, and with that funding and, of course, the campaign monies that we raised, a small portion of those campaign monies, we are going to be able to put a path to level 3 quality child care center in the Methodist Northlake campus, which happens to sit right in a child care desert in, mm-hmm. in Gary.
I understand from Early Learning Indiana, their information shows on a statewide basis that more than 45% of Hoosier children live in a child care desert. Is that a higher percentage here in particular in Lake County because of our situation here?
Yeah, so the child care deserts are technically by census tract. And so we have three deserts in Gary. There's one in Crown Point. There's one in Whiting and Highland and Cherville. And what they mean by child care desert, technically, is that there are a lot of jobs, but there's not enough quality child care seats to provide child care for all the children that reside in that area as well.
It's quite a challenge. It sounds, we have families that certainly could have, I guess, could use the help. They're looking desperately with decent jobs to be able to find a place to be able to bring the youngsters so they're well cared for while they have their jobs and still can pick them up in the evening.
Yeah, we really see this as a two-generation approach because while, you know, helping families access better-paying jobs is a key focus for us. A lot of the families, you know, if they don't have that quality child care, they often choose to stay at home. So this strategy is going to benefit employers, you know, the parents, and of course, give the children a great start and have them ready for kindergarten when they're experiencing that quality child care.
Tell us a little bit about Tanika Davis. She is listed as the local child care provider that's going to help you all the most in getting this child care center set up at the North Lake campus.
Yeah, when we so we have a work group that we're facilitating, one around jobs, one around child care. And the conversation that those groups started having was about, you know, looking for a partner that could provide the child care in an existing space and perhaps for an employer who was struggling with, you know, hiring, retaining, advancing employees because of child care. And Geminis Corporation participates regularly in that work group. And Tanika Davis, who runs Faith Child Care, was one of the first providers that they recommended consult with. She's got a couple of other child care centers in Gary. She is a wonderful, wonderful woman. Very excited about this project. This is a perfect collaboration to illustrate how coming together can make it happen. You know, Methodist isn't in the business of child care, and employers who have looked to provide a child care center on their properties, it's too expensive and it's out of their realm of expertise. Tanika Davis, who has the expertise, doesn't necessarily have the capital to renovate or put a facility in. So Lake Erie United Way, you know, convenes the partners, comes to the table with the funding. You know, Tanika is able to to get started and actually sustain that child care center for years to come on her own. So we're essentially funding the initial, you know, renovation, perhaps some subsidies for families who might not be able to afford it, and then we're out and moving on to another important project. So it's really an ideal collaboration for us.
Tell us a little about the plans for this year, because I guess the goal is to have the child care center up and running at the North Lake campus by the end of the calendar year. So it sounds
correct.
Like there's a lot of things that have to be done, certainly in the meantime, and you're planning for, I guess, a very impressive operation. You want to get several dozen youngsters be able to be situated in there as time goes on this year.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that the stars aligned on this project is that Methodist had what used to be an adolescent behavioral health unit that was currently not being used for that purpose. And so we already had a wing, so to speak, that had its own entrance. It has lots of rooms already. There's already a security system. There's an outdoor area that can be easily converted to a playground for the children. You know, so the renovation that we have to do really is limited to, you know, a couple of walls have to come down, a couple have to come up. We've got to put a little bit of plumbing in to accommodate the licensing requirements of the state for a past the quality level 3 center. But because so much of, the building already, fits the project, we're going to be able to move pretty quickly.
Now, obviously, childcare involves more than just from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and there'll be some after-hours care, I'm sure, that'll have to be provided. Does this give an opportunity to be able to allow that because of the setting that you're putting this in?
Absolutely. We actually, we intend, Methodist is a 24-hour operation, and they've got the security there. There is the activity. They've got employees who need to access. We actually, throughout the county, need more 24-hour care providers because we have a lot of shift work when it comes to manufacturing and healthcare in particular. So, we are gonna get the child care center up and running initially with about 40 seats. And we will continue to expand the hours so that minimally we're an 18-hour provider with the goal of becoming a 24-hour provider when the demand is there.
Lisa, take a minute and talk about how Early Learning Indiana fits into this. They had a competition, I guess, in a way, for organizations around the Hoosier State to be able to apply for the money that's available. I think they have a million-dollar pot, so to speak, that they're working with here to supply organizations like this one going on, this collaboration between Methodist Hospitals and the Lake Area United Way. In conversations with the folks in Indianapolis about this, you obviously had to explain pretty much like the business plan model that you're going to adapt everything to make it work. What were their thoughts about what's been happening up here in the region?
Well, you know, they obviously, you know, they specifically made the dollars available to initiatives that would benefit a child care, you know, a technically child care desert area. So their intention is to make more child care available, whether it's a project like ours, where it's basically a new center in a desert area, or it's an enhancement that expands, you know, more seats. We're really grateful for this opportunity. I mean, this is a sizable grant that we're receiving, and we've had the idea when the grant opportunity came up. We pulled the partners together to talk about, you know, whether this was realistic to do in the allotted time that early learning, you know, afforded. And all the partners agreed that it was a win-win-win. And we had to submit a letter of intent, which basically described kind of broadly, you know, the scope of the project. And that was accepted. They wanted to go further with that application. So then we had to provide more detail on it. And of course, all the partners had to demonstrate their commitment, to making it happen. And here we are. And I think it's one of many, you know, that will come. There are some other partnerships that we're talking about in other parts of the county. And you know, there's a backup care strategy that we're working on. When a parent is employed and their child is out of school, whether they're sick or it's a vacation opportunity, we don't have backup child care in this community, and we are determined to bring that here, you know, that will benefit families and employers.
Lisa, what kind of impact do you see this happening generationally, on this community, all of the communities, we should say, in Lake County in particular, that will be able to benefit from what is being planned there in Gary?
Well, like I said, we are so excited because I think it's the first, you know, collaboration that is really going to demonstrate our new work. It is a two-generation approach. You know, the parents are benefiting because they have quality child care. They don't have to worry about whether their child is safe and if they're learning and if they're prepared for school while they work. It'll be easily accessible, for thousands of employees at Methodist alone. And for the child, there's so much research out there that proves that a child is so much more likely to succeed in school and college and career if they are ready for kindergarten. And that requires a curriculum. We've got to raise awareness around that, too. I don't know that parents in the community really understand the value of that quality curriculum at such an early age. The providers know it, the educators know it, but we have to educate parents and the business community, because not only does it benefit the families, but this is a future workforce. So we are training, workers of the future. So employers need to understand how critical that early learning experience is and how it comes back to them in their workforce.
Well, Lisa, I'm looking forward to getting more updates as we go on through 2020 on this project, and congratulations to the Lake Area United Way, as well as to Methodist Hospitals for getting into this collaboration with the help of Early Learning Indiana. And thank you for spending time with us to explain what this is all about and what kind of benefits and great opportunities this will give for everyone who would take advantage of it here in the region. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Doughty is the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. With another edition of Green Fleet Radio, here's Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. Bill McCall. He's the communications manager for the Indiana Toll Road. Bill, welcome to the show.
Carl, thanks for having me.
So, Bill, with the thousands traveling on the Indiana Toll Road every day, what is the Indiana Toll Road doing to promote sustainability?
Sustainability is built into the fabric of the Indiana Toll Road. It starts with our new administration building, if you've seen it, which features smart heating and cooling, efficient water management, and solar panels that offset, about one-fifth of the electricity that we consume. Two of our travel plazas, they're also outfitted with solar panels, and we use solar technology to power many of the signs and lights that keep travelers safe on the toll road. That, plus in the future, we're planning to provide electric charging stations, helping grow the movement of sustainable travel.
Well, that sounds very exciting. So what do you see as some of the biggest challenges associated with sustainability at the Indiana Toll Road, Bill?
When you think about it, our workspace is 157 miles long. So we have to make sure that we keep sustainability in mind every step of the way. At our office, at the travel plazas, at the maintenance barns, and more, we've eliminated all our underground storage tanks and upgraded our entire fleet of vehicles to make sure that we're being as efficient as possible. Most importantly, we make sure that to only work with contractors who share our sustainable values. We work directly with our partners to minimize risk and prevent environmental damage.
So why is it important to have LEED certified buildings when most of your customers spend all the time on the road?
Well, we want to be a state leader in every possible way. By reducing the impact of our administration building has on the environment, we act as a steward for other companies in Indiana. For example, this year we have had local business professionals, members of the United States Green Building Council, and local students tour our LEED certified building. While these visitors, they may not directly benefit from our sustainability effort, we're having a greater impact on our community. We spoke to some of these local professionals about how to obtain LEED certification, and we hope to continue inspiring sustainable efforts in our community.
Well, for folks who haven't seen it, I know that facility is just amazing. There's so many great attributes to the environment that you've got there. So, you know, congratulations. That definitely is a wonderful building.
It was a team effort. And, we worked with a lot of local entities that brought ideas for sustainable use. And really, it was a collaborative effort. I was happy to be a part of it.
What are some of the ways you focus on sustainability related to the roads itself?
Really, there's a lot, maybe too many to count. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, we've upgraded our fleet to be more fuel efficient alongside the removal of all the underground storage tanks. This year, we've also developed a new salt storage dome where trucks can be loaded inside the dome itself, eliminating the risk of salt falling onto the ground and into the waterways. We're also developing a brine system that will allow more salt to stick to the road, allowing us to reduce our salt usage by 25%. So when you think about it, so much of what we do is about the domino effect. A brine system, which means we use less salt, which means we don't need to use plows, trucks as often, which then means that we can use less fuel and less salt. So we're focused on finding those solutions that affect various aspects of the operation.
So do you also encourage your employees to be sustainable as well?
Of course. I mean, you can tell what kind of focus we have as a company, and our employees are really on board. I mentioned earlier our office is focused on reducing paper use and recycling what we do use. So we also make sure to include our employees and community partners in all our sustainable efforts. This year we planted 300 trees along the toll road. Through these events, we've educated the community, helped create a sustainable biodome, and gave our employees a way to improve the community in the places that we work and live in.
So, Bill, what's next for the Indiana Toll Road Sustainability Program?
It's exciting, Carl. You know, our sustainable efforts are constant. Mm-hmm. As always, we will continue to support the community through our stewardship and outreach, But we're also working on providing, as I mentioned, the electric charging stations to our customers, as well as researching other ways to make our fleet more sustainable. Overall, we're focused on that holistic approach to sustainability. We'll make every little change we can and encourage the community to follow the lead.
So how can our listeners learn more about your efforts, Bill?
Please go to IndianaTollRoad.org. On it, we have sustainability pages. You can view the efforts that we have in the works, what we're planning on doing, and always learn more. Reach out to us. We'd love to hear your experiences on the Indiana Toll Road.
Well, congratulations on all the great work that you're doing. Keep up the great efforts, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Bill McCall, Communications Manager for the Indiana Toll Road. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us, and remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and NERPSI, and you can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and podcasts for Green Fleet Radio are on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Erosion is threatening communities in northwest Indiana as well as along the Chicago lakefront. Residents and officials say the situation is being made worse by the state's inaction. Reporter Michael Puente went on a tour of the affected area along the lake, and he brings us this report.
It's been a busy new year for Jeff Benson. As president of the Beverly Shores Town Council, erosion is an issue he faces daily. Benson has been spending most of his time shoring up vulnerable sections of the town's lakefront. He explains there are some spots where very little stands between the lake and people's homes.
The cement wall that had been there had collapsed into the lake. Look how close it is to the road.
Benson has been trying to come up with solutions from keeping an ever-rising Lake Michigan from washing away the town's sandy dunes. It's already swallowed up a small section of Lakefront Drive, which hugs the shoreline.
So did you have to shut down the road?
Not yet. We've reduced the speed limit and asking people to not be here, but right in front of you is, see, it's cordoned off,
yeah.
And if we just kept going, then the road's in the lake. It's gone.
Benson says some homes are at risk of damage or being lost, but that's not all.
What we're really worried about here in Beverly Shores is under our road is gas lines and water lines. Sand erodes so quickly, and if the road goes in, the gas line goes in, ruptures, and we got a real problem on our hands.
In late December, volunteers worked feverishly to rebuild a 100-foot section of rocks called revetment that the lake had earlier eroded and exposed a small section of earth and tree roots. The revetment is to protect the nearby road and an area that is a popular spot for tourists since it's surrounded by the Indiana Dunes National Park.
It was very dangerous because the areas around it were hardened structures, and it was an open slot exposed to 300 miles of lake with the waves going right into our sand dune that with no revetment, and it would erode very, very quickly.
The town spent $300,000 of its own money to do the work, but now there's not much left for anything else. It went looking for more from the state of Indiana, but was turned away, even after the county it's in, Porter County, declared a state of emergency. WBEZ reached out multiple times to the state's governor, Eric Holcomb, for comment, but were turned down or asked to speak to the state's Department of Homeland Security. There are multiple structures threatened by the pounding waves, including five homes that were part of the Century of Progress World's Fair in Chicago in 1933. The homes, including a pink Floridian-style home, were moved to Beverly Shores from Chicago 87 years ago.
And I would say it's the most valuable real estate in the whole state of Indiana that is on the brink of falling in.
This worry isn't exclusive to Beverly Shores. Just down the road, Portage is dealing with its own erosion issues.
Well, I was out there. The wind was fierce again and just beating the shoreline to death.
Sue Lynch is the mayor of Portage. She's worried about a $17 million lakefront pavilion, a major draw for tourists that also lies within the Indiana Dunes National Park.
I do expect the lake levels to rise, and I just expect that more homes and the potentially that beautiful building out there will be in peril.
Lynch is dumbfounded by the lack of response from the state. Porter County, which houses both communities, was turned down by Indiana's Department of Homeland Security because there hasn't been enough damage at this point, though they have promised they would work with officials to come up with short-term solutions, but they've been light on specifics. The state also won't help pay for a $1.6 million shoreline study by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps says it would cover half the cost.
I don't think they hear our voice up here, and that's kind of historically the problem that Northwest Indiana's had. I mean, money from our industries goes down to support our state, but nothing of consequence comes back up here.
So for now, it's a waiting game between seeing action from state lawmakers or further damage from Mother Nature. I'm Michael Puente.
In a busy section of Maryville, Indiana, is a quietly operating business which has picked up some very important notoriety lately. The company we're referring to is SimCorp Incorporated, which is, simply put, a cybersecurity company. We have the president and CEO of the company of SimCorp Incorporated, Robert Johnson III, with us. Thank you for stopping by here in the studios and talking about the business and this very important piece of information that we've got about how SimCorp has gotten to become one of the hot 150 cybersecurity companies in the country and around the world for 2020. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about SimCorp Incorporated, how you got started, It's a very busy company, very quietly operating, but very busy, certainly these days with all the problems that we're encountering with cybersecurity.
Sure. Well, we actually started in 1997, and initially we were focused on doing process automation and control, and that was actually automating manufacturing facilities. Mm-hmm. And while working in that space, one of the opportunities that we identified was that it seemed like it was possible without much effort to jeopardize the integrity of the manufacturing process or those critical machines that actually run our processes. So that encouraged us to develop the first version of our software, which at the time was called SimTrack Industrial, and the name of our product in general is called SimTrack. And that product helped identify unexpected changes to systems that help run manufacturing processes, those specialized computer systems.
Were you finding back then in these early days of the company that, and since you're talking about industrial processes, that these were probably processes that might have been put onto, we'll just say, a floppy disk? You know, the technology was very simple back then compared to what it is now. It was not as much on the internet-based systems as we have today, was it?
Not quite. But still, you had some of these control system networks being connected to the internet.
Right.
You also, and really the threat point at the time were USB sticks and laptops being carried throughout the organization. And what was the possibility that that laptop was infected and somehow altering, you know, how those manufacturing processes actually worked? Now, we ended up morphing over time and extending outside of that process automation realm into the general enterprise. Mm-hmm. And that was a big shift for us. But the mentality stayed the same. You know, we've always been of the mind that processes are critical and mission critical, in fact. And because of that, when we developed our software and targeted towards the general enterprise, this had that same thought process. How do we ensure business continues to run?
Did you find that over the years that you branched out from industrial into other business ventures that the problem was still there? In fact, it got worse because of the fact that it was so easy to break into systems and infect them somehow or another. And did you find that there wasn't any real difference between, say, the processes in a factory or a manufacturer as to those in, say, in a major business?
No. The problem was really the same. And what we do is we actually detect unexpected changes to devices and servers and network devices. And if it changes, we let you know about it. And then here's where this process automation mentality kicks in.
Yeah.
We can automatically fix it, and our software can change things back to how they actually were before the attack. You mentioned things morphing over time. You know, I remember when we started, we were looking at about 78,000 threats a day, new types of malware, new types of threats every day. And but then about 2014, we hit 348,000 new types of malware, new threats a day. And as of today, we're well beyond 1.2 million new variants of malware every day.
Do you find that these are new ideas, or that the whoever's out there hacking, finding ways to break into the systems? Or do you find just maybe different versions of the same sort of malware that has developed over time?
That's a good question. It's actually a combination of both. There are always new ideas out there and new ways to exploit systems. However, we've also hit this point in time where there's an entire economy that's based around actually selling malware that can be customized by the purchaser, the person purchasing that tool may not have a high level of technical ability. So now this has become, becoming more of a commodity to an extent.
Now, how did Cybersecurity Ventures, the organization that put SimCorp Incorporated on the latest list, the hot 150 cybersecurity companies in the world in 2020, how did they find out about you folks, and how did they in turn determine that you were best suited for the list this year?
Well, Cybersecurity Ventures does an analysis of the entire security market. So their analysts and folks are constantly reaching out to understand your product, how it fits into the security space, and a problem that it solves. So this entire process is based on merit, and they take into consideration not only the leadership, the innovation in the company, but they also speak with customers and analysts to help make that final determination.
Now, how did Cybersecurity Ventures, in turn, they found out about you? Certainly by keeping an eye on businesses, probably from recommendations from other businesses. How do you rank with the big boys out there, seeing as I guess your company, and there's one of the company I noted on the list that's based in Minneapolis. So you have only two in the entire Midwest, and then we have a number of course, in the United States and around the world. How did it come out that you're on the list this year?
Well, I'm happy to be part of that short list. Mm-hmm. But you're right; most of the companies on that list are quite large, and but we've been holding our own. I think that we have a culture of innovation at SimCorp, and a lot of that's driven just by the general culture to me in the Midwest, particularly here in Northwest Indiana.
Did you find Northwest Indiana as being not only a good place to establish a business, but to be able to grow over time? Because I suppose you could have taken your business to Chicago, or you could have been in one of the suburbs, but Northwest Indiana is where you're based.
Right. Well, I grew up here in Northwest Indiana, and the easiest path for would have been to start a business out in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
But we really wanted to make an impact here in Northwest Indiana. We're trying to make this shift from a manufacturing economy to a services type of economy, and we can only do that if we all individually participate in making that possible. And on top of it all, if you look at the resources that we have right here in Northwest Indiana, the human resources, they're really outstanding. There's certain things that you can't get in many other areas of the country. And that's, for instance, loyalty, the culture of hard work, where you know that this person is going to actually work that 40 hours, and to be honest, they'll probably work 60. So that culture of getting things done and keeping a practical attitude about how you accomplish things, I think is unique to this area, and I think contributes to our success.
Did you find that the people here in Northwest Indiana, in particular, as you mentioned, they're the kind that will work hard and develop themselves as well as the business along the way, that it's made it easier to be able to find more folks to make the business grow?
I think it does. It makes it easier, but also it reduces the stress of high turnover. If you look at other areas of the country, turnover is extremely high in the IT sector, and we have relatively low turnover. And I think a lot of that's because of the level of loyalty and the general culture that we're able to maintain here in the Midwest.
Now, looking into the future for SimCorp Incorporated, and we don't want you to give away any trade secrets, certainly, but what areas do you see that are out there that you'd like to see the company, if they're not already into working on, but to be able to get into to help in the cybersecurity area?
Well, you know, the mission of our company is to help you detect unexpected changes throughout your IT infrastructure. So we're constantly working to expand on what we're monitoring throughout your infrastructure. Right now, yes, we're monitoring servers and network devices and industrial controllers. Mm-hmm. But we'd also like to extend that to other items, for instance, industrial Internet of Things, Internet of Things configurations, because that's where we're going to see a lot of growth over time.
Well, congratulations for SimCorp Incorporated picking up the honor this year by being chosen by the Cybersecurity Ventures and in Cybercrime Magazine, I think is what they publish as well, and being on the list this year of the hot 150 cybersecurity companies in not only the United States, but in the world. And we hope that you'll get to be back on the list for 2021.
Well, we hope so as well, and thank you so much for bringing me on your show.
Robert Johnson III is the president and CEO of SimCorp Incorporated. It's a company that's involved in cybersecurity ventures, and it's based right here in Northwest Indiana. Let's go from cybersecurity issues to the issues of supplying quality education for Hoosier youngsters. InvestEd is an Indiana-based nonprofit that's focused on providing financial aid literacy and some transparent education funding options for Hoosier students and their families as they look to higher education options out here in Indiana. And they've just put out a new survey. And to tell us more about it, we have Bill Wozniak, who is with InvestEd. Bill, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having us, Chris. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's an interesting study that has come out and some rather, maybe for some, shocking statistics. One of which I know here is that nearly 9 out of every 10 Hoosiers, so we're talking about 87% actually, really value education beyond high school. And it's, I guess, not surprising because we know that going from the governor all the way down through the administration and the rest of state government, they're encouraging folks who are not quite ready for the new workforce in the 21st century to work that way, to take the educational steps they need to take. Tell us more about the study and how InvestEd helps it.
So once a year at the end of the calendar year, we send out a survey, work with a company, and send out a survey and interview people across the state to get their opinions on higher education funding, and things like that. And as you pointed out, almost 9 out of 10 responded with a perceived value of education beyond high school, something that is very important. This is consistent with what we saw last year. This also dovetails with what we see in our work across the state helping families with funding college information. So the Hoosiers seeing value in post-secondary education very high, and it continues to be something that is perceived as a very important thing.
When you take a look at these figures, and that such a high percentage of figures have this value in higher education, does it surprise you at all? You say it's a kind of a continuation from last year, isn't it?
Yes. The interesting thing, I believe, is when we take 3 of the data points, the second data point that I think is important is the 80% are concerned about the average amount of student loan debt. And so that very high as well, 8 out of 10 concerned about the average amount of student loan debt that students take on. And so you have the first step where people value the education beyond high school. Second step, a very high amount are very concerned about debt associated with that education. And then the third part, the 91% that want free and transparent help with planning for college, I think the 3 of these taken together show the value perception, then the concern about the debt that may be taken on to get the education, but also over 90% want some help with this process so that they can get the education that they value but avoid some of the debt that they're nervous about, I believe.
Mm-hmm. We talk here about the importance of workforce development, about the move that is getting the Hoosiers ready for the workplace of the 21st century. And we have, I'm sure, a lot of companies that are doing their best to help attract and retain workers in these jobs in particular. Are they being encouraged, as far as you know, and do they need to be encouraged more to be able to help those people that they have brought into the workplace to help pay for these expenses of college and make sure that they get their student loan debt as low as possible?
This, again, is something we're seeing day to day, and then the survey dovetailed with what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
When you open up different articles online and you see different companies across the country and across Indiana adding new types of benefits for their employees, it often is something along the lines of paying down student loan debt or helping with going to college, funding assistance, things of that nature. This is a type of benefit that more and more students and workers and families are interested in. And so as opposed to 401k or healthcare, some of these things that are more traditional, these type of benefits are being really asked for by the new workers. So then the question becomes, how can the companies do it? And there's a lot of different ways that they can go about it. But in our survey, 81% said that companies are better positioned to attract and retain talent if they offer some of these types of balance, of these type of benefits. And then 82% say that cities and towns will gain a competitive advantage if they offer some of this free help in planning or paying or refinancing or these different types of things. So it's something that a lot of our respondents said they're very interested in.
Well, it sounds like that there are a lot of organizations as well as businesses, and we're talking about organizations and communities that realize that the people that come into the workforce in these new jobs that are created, that have come out of college, they have to look to the short term as well. They have to deal with these immediate problems of student debt, as well as look all the way ahead to retirement, too.
They absolutely do, and that's one of the things that I liked about the survey this year. When there's sort of a theme, sometimes you don't get that lucky, right? It doesn't come out that way. But I think there's sort of a theme right through the survey this year where people say, I want to have a good life. I want to have an opportunity down the road. And so, you know what? Post-secondary education of some form is going to be important for that. And then I need to fund it in the least debt-filled way possible. So how do I go about that? I think some trusted resources would be good. And then when I get to my job, wherever that is, if that entity helped me with limiting my debt, paying off my debt, avoiding additional debt, things of that nature, it's consistent. Before, during, and after the education, there's a real theme this year in what we heard back from Hoosiers that were surveyed.
If you will, tell us what InvestEd can help do. I noticed in mentioning what you've been able to talk about in the survey that there's more obviously importance to being transparent. How can InvestEd help in making sure family members and students as well are getting the information they need and the help they need so this way they're not going to be buried in debt and student debt in particular?
Absolutely. InvestEd is a not-for-profit here in Indiana that helps any Hoosier family anywhere in Indiana with completely free planning for paying college help. And so we work with over 150 Indiana high schools where we give over 500 presentations each year. We help over 10,000 individual families with calls or live chat or even in-person meetings, whatever works best for the family. And so it's any type of planning, how to pay for college question, whether it's the FAFSA, whether it's how do I get going, my student is a 9th and 10th grader, how do we get going, whether it's working with different high schools, any of those types of things. And then also after college or during college, when families have more questions along the lines of, wow, I have this debt. Am I stuck forever? Are there different things I can do? Can I do federal consolidation? It's really a before, during, and after type help that we provide, and we're happy to do so. And more schools and families are taking advantage of it, and that's a very good thing.
And the website is InvestEd, that's I-N-V-E-S-T-E-D, Indiana, one word, .org. And Bill Wozniak, thank you very much for talking about the results of the survey, and hopefully that people will turn to you folks and find out more information about getting the help they might need.
Chris, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Now, you're welcome. Have you noticed more seniors are in the workforce these days? Well, that's a question that Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer has been asked. And he talked with us on Regionally Speaking not long ago about the different types of retirement strategies that seem to be set up so that working seniors can take advantage of them.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, a lot of that, Chris, I think is a reflection of, you know, the fact that people are living longer, number one. So retirement has been stretched out from, you know, what used to be typically 10, 15 years to, you know, more of the 20, 25, even 30 years for a lot of people. And, you know, a lot of your benefits, even Social Security, are the full benefits are being pushed back later. And I think the result is you're seeing, you know, the population begin to age that or before you begin retirement.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the tips that you can pass along to us and tell us about, if we're not aware of, to make sure that we are ready for retirement if we're at that age or approaching that age?
Well, I think first, the government's realizing that they need to do something to allow people to catch up, you know, to put more money towards retirement. And the catch-up provisions continue to increase within our normal retirement vehicles like the 401Ks and the IRAs. And those catch-up provisions have increased again this year. You know, for the 401K, you have your standard $19,000 for everybody, but the 50 and over can now contribute an additional $6,000 in contributions to the 401K. And the IRA has gone up to $6,000, and you have a catch-up provision of
$1,000. Mm-hmm. How about looking ahead for, I guess, if we haven't set up a strategy or taken advantage of the ones that are out there to be able to use our tax dollars the best?
Well, I think the biggest thing today is the new tax laws have really created some unique opportunities that just simply didn't exist prior to these tax laws, mm-hmm. in terms of which strategies would be the best. And with the tax implications and the rates being as low as they are, the non-taxable contributions like the Roth can be a lot more advantageous than they have been in the past and can help diversify those assets that are sitting in retirement.
And we talked about this before, of course, about trying to plan ahead and literally, in this case, creating an income plan if you don't have one, right?
Well, I think ultimately we've talked about this many times, Chris. It has to start with the end in mind. And, you know, it's a common phrase that people have heard, but it's kind of hard to get to where you want to go if you don't know exactly what it is you want in retirement or where it is you want to end up. And,
yeah.
And the income plan is first and foremost that map, you know, that guideline. Okay, where is it that I want to go? What are the things I can do? And then actively work on it to constantly improve that plan and try to avoid costly mistakes, but, you know, give you a better idea of what the target is. What do I need to have set aside? What type of assets do I have to have? Where do they have to be in order to accomplish my goals?
Now, for folks that are in retirement or approaching retirement, and they are maybe trying to get things planned out as they can, but, of course, they're looking ahead to try and decide, well, do I really want to work? Do I want to officially retire, or do I want to continue to work into my retirement year, so to speak? But there's some things that you need to think about, and I know that there are three in particular that you bring up often. Let's bring those up, please.
Sure. I mean, the first thing is, you know, how you envision your retirement. And a lot of folks, they don't like idle time. You know, they've been active their entire careers. They've worked, you know, constantly and consistently their entire careers. And, you know, they feel like, you know, if I continue to work, it's just something that they would enjoy doing, something that they, you know, would feel fit in well with their retirement. But it's a second career that it's something that they enjoy to do. And they have fun doing it, you know, and it adds the additional income.
Mm-hmm.
I think also, you know, part of it is, you know, most people, when they retire, we typically find that the first 5, 8, maybe 10 years of retirement generally are going to have a lot more bucket list items being accomplished, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so the nest egg might satisfy their retirement lifestyle, but even with the sizable nest egg, a lot of times they just want to, you know, add to that nest egg for some of the things that they like to do. The key is if you're going to do that, is whatever am I doing, does it give me the flexibility to still maintain, you know, what I see my retirement? So how you envision your retirement, is it solely focused on pastimes? Is it focused on grandkids? Is it focused on, you know, just hanging out and relaxing? Whatever it might be, You need to envision that structure that keeps you busy, and working in retirement may be a fit, you know, if you want a more active retirement.
Now, I suppose, too, for example, if you're a businessman and you've decided to step aside from the business or the industry that you happen to have been business in, but you still want to participate and help out with many organizations, in particular like those that are out there that help new businesses get started, get some of their problems resolved, because you have the experience you can put to it. You may not necessarily get paid, but you need to kind of plan ahead if you do want to be able to do that kind of volunteer work and still be able to pay for everything, right?
Absolutely. And, yeah. And again, we sound like a broken record sometimes, but it always goes back to, you know, what's my plan? You know, yeah. Not only the income plan, that income plan really needs to incorporate, you know, how do I envision my retirement? What do I see it as? You know, what are the things I want to do? How do I want to spend my time? You know, we've done what we had to up to that point. Now it's more or less, you know, what do I want to do? And there's a big difference, I tell people, between having and wanting, right? If I want to do some things and maybe I have some passions, I have a lot of friends that have gone through their career and they might have a charitable interest in mind to say, hey, my passion in retirement, and I want to stay active. I want to figure out how to, you know, create this type of fundraising for this particular organization, or I want to spend time, you know, working in this personal arena because it's something I've always wanted to do, but it couldn't support what I needed to have, you know, during my working years.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer with some thoughts about more seniors in the workplace these days. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.